Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, our weekly performing arts magazine, with yours truly, David LaTulip, as your host. A full hour of community happenings this hour on Open Air. We'll be hearing from conductor Ming Luke of the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra, who will talk about their upcoming performances of the Verdi Requiem. Conductor Megan Solomon of the San Francisco Choral Artists and violinist Mads Tolling will talk about their upcoming collaboration. Playwright, performer, juggler, and clown Sarah Felder shares details about her solo show at the Marsh. Plus, we'll hear details about the new Hope Moore dance season and her collaborator, Christian Burns. At the end of the hour, Diane Keough will stop by with some family activities for the summer months and some free concerts down on the peninsula. Stay with us. Civil War era music, courtesy of Kate and Anna McGarrigle, Hard Times Come Again No More. I thought it fitting to introduce our first segment here on Open Air and to welcome guest Sarah Felder. Sarah is a playwright and performer who has a solo show at the Marsh. She, over the past three decades, has created a body of work that juggles personal narrative, circus shtick, and social justice. In such shows, she has tackled the making of the atom bomb in The Lady Upstairs, histories of three great comic actors and activists keeping up with the Joneses, those Joneses being Joan Holden, Mencken, and Shirley. She's addressed the marginalization of queer and Yiddish culture in Shtick, same-sex marriage in June Bride, and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in Out of Sight. So glad you solved that problem for us, Sarah.
Yeah, right. That's what solo theater is here to do for you, David.
I'm very grateful. Believe me, the world is grateful for that show.
Yeah.
Your show is at The Marsh currently, themarsh.org themarsh.org for more information. Now, as I understand it, the underlying premise of the show lies in the question, did Abraham Lincoln suffer from clinical depression?
Well, now it's actually been shown that Abraham Lincoln probably was what we would call today clinically depressed. And when I started writing a show about mental illness, I looked to him because here you have this great American icon, really great international icon. And if he can suffer through depression and rise above that to do what he did in the world, then I think it's an inspiring story. So I wanted to include that story along with a more contemporary story of two college students, one of who's dealing with bipolar disorder. And the show kind of goes back and forth between both of them. As you noted in your introduction, what I like to do with solo theater is treat these very serious topics, very serious content, and in a very light style. So I really believe in comedy as a way to talk about these issues. And you talk about Lincoln's depression and other people's depression and bipolar disorder. And of course, I went to comedy, as I did in another show with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and same-sex weddings and other things like that.
Right. And a lot of your solo shows are drawn from personal experience. So how is that tying into this show?
Well, this show is actually inspired by a friend of mine, Paoli, who now has passed a couple of years ago. But she struggled with bipolar disorder for years. And I was a little bit on that journey with her as one of her friends. And I remember she told me, she said, if you ever put any of this material on stage, make sure it's funny, because that's our redemption. And I was like, but Paoli, this really isn't funny. You know, this is heartbreaking for many of us. And she's like, yeah, I know. Just make sure it's funny. And you'll note to make sure I put it in the title. So the title of the show is actually Melancholy, a Comedy, so I could keep my promise to Paoli. So it's drawn from a lot of my experiences with people that I've known, and it really explores not just what it means to battle those demons, but also what happens when you approach the edge, or when you see someone approach the edge, and the role of the caregiver, the role of the friend, the role of the lover in these relationships.
Mm-hmm. The show also is inspired by your love of history, as mm-hmm. as your other shows have been. Mm-hmm. What was your connection and mm-hmm. fascination with Lincoln?
Well, I have to say, I was just in the car one day, and I heard on the radio about this book called Lincoln's Melancholy by Joshua Schenck, and where he, and this was about 10 years ago now, but he was really the main person who came in and talked about Lincoln's depression, really. And that's when I knew that I had a show, when I could tell a contemporary story and also kind of go back and forth, as we said, with this great American icon. And what I love about Schenck's book, actually, is his subtitle, which is How Depression Challenged a President and Fueled His Greatness. Hmm. And so Schenck's theory is that Lincoln became president and did great things in the world, not in spite of having suffered great bouts of depression, but because of it.
Well, and you know, I think that's similar to a lot of historical creative people as well. I mean, we'd look to the music of Tchaikovsky. If he didn't have such a tortured life, it'd be like everything would be in C major.
I think that's a great point. And I have to say, one of the things that's come up for me in doing this is actually the connection between mental illness and creativity, which, you know, seems to be, as you mentioned with Tchaikovsky and about a million other people, to be so paramount too. But I love history. As you said, I studied it in college. The show is about someone who's, you know, who's a historian, who's actually trying to understand what Lincoln went through at the same time having this relationship with this woman who is going over the edge. So the character Sarah is negotiating these things.
So what are the characters that you're bringing to the stage?
Well, there's a character named Sarah, and she's the historian, and she's just trying. She's very kind of staid and very conservative.
What's the ratio of fiction versus your own personal life in this?
You know, it's always hard. I mean, you know, the goal is always to create great theater, and sometimes that is very factually based from my life. But I will say, emotionally, the show is quite true, and it's a lot of experiences that I've had. The other main character is Anna, who's the woman who's suffering from bipolar disorder, and she's this like beautiful, vibrant, vital, exciting woman. And she is a composite of many people that I've known in mm-hmm. my life.
Other characters involved, or those the two main folks?
Well, Lincoln's best friend, Joshua Speed. He's a character. And Lincoln may or, I don't want to, you know, give any spoilers. Lincoln may or may not show up himself.
Oh, I see. Okay. I thought you were going to say that they slept together. And they did, because of the convention of their where they were in Illinois. They had a small bed that they had to share together. So speculation is rife a little bit.
Yes, you know your history. That's good. Yeah, it's always an issue when you talk about, especially when I talk about Lincoln, you know, as someone who does queer theater also. But we haven't seen, I have to say historically, we haven't seen proof that they were lovers, although we don't really, you know, who's to say? I don't know. I wasn't there.
Right. Well, this is also taking us on a journey to a Lincoln lookalike convention, I understand?
Yeah. I have to say, I went to a Lincoln lookalike convention, which was, I have to say, one of the most surreal experiences of my life. And it's about 50 guys who look exactly like Lincoln.
You hold up your $5 bill and you compare shots.
Yes, and a lot of Mary Todds and a lot of other people. There were some General Grants, and Frederick Douglass actually made an appearance. So it was amazing. I mean,
where was that?
This was in Ohio. They have it different places every year. But I did put that in the show. I thought it was really, there's something about embodying. I mean, what does theater do, right? We try to embody, you know. So I could give you a lecture about whether Lincoln was depressed. But in theater, like, we want to kind of take that on. It's three-dimensional, right? Mm. And then we have such a direct relationship with the audience also, right? So the audience is invited in a very different way, you know, in all these art forms that you're going to be talking about today. So even though it's a bit campy and a bit silly, you know, when I saw these guys dressed as Lincoln, there's something also very deep about it, because I also talk about him in the first person as if they are him. But there is something about embodying that I think is, you know, it's what we try to do in history, like get inside them. What's going on here? Mm-hmm. And if we can embody someone else's experience, then we have, you know, more access, I think, to, you know, the humanity of the world, mm-hmm. you know, which is also what theater does and what theater audiences try to do by coming in and, you know, seeing themselves somehow, you know, in the play or seeing their experience.
Mm-hmm. And so we're going to see the interaction between Anna and Sarah. You're going to take us to a Lincoln look-alike convention and act-alike convention. And speaking of campy, I understand you're also taking us to the Campanile in Berkeley Camp.
Well,
how is that tied in?
Look at you go. yeah, there's a scene at the Campanile, and it's kind of the high point of this relationship between these two women, and they actually sneak in and make it to the top of the Campanile, which is, I would say, the moment before the down. You know, they go to the great heights, literally, and then go to the great downfall from there, too.
You mentioned Jonathan Schenck, and I understand that this coming Sunday he's going to be there to talk about this very issue.
Yeah, thanks for bringing him up. So this Sunday we have a very, very special event, and I really want to invite all your listeners. At 4 p.m. on Sunday, we have the author Joshua Schenck coming from Los Angeles, and he's going to talk about Lincoln's melancholy and, again, how depression challenged a president and fueled his greatness. It's a wonderful talk. I've actually heard him speak before. It'll be free. There will be food there. And again, it's 4 p.m. this Sunday at the Marsh, San Francisco, for free. And if people want to stay later, they can come see my performance at 7 p.m. that night, too.
Oh, very nice. And how long do you anticipate the show running, then?
The show will run until June 28th. And it's Saturdays at 5 and Sundays at 7.
And you've got some other special events happening throughout the month of June associated with the show. And are these also at the Marsh?
Yeah, then we have some post-show discussions. So there's one on Sunday, June 14th, with Jeff Raz about clowning and healing, and one on June 28th with a representative from the National Alliance for Mental Illness on queer identity and mental health on June 28th.
Yeah. More information about the show at themarsh.org, or you can also learn about all things Sarah at sarahfelder.com. Sarah, thanks for coming in today, and I wish you a wonderful show. It sounds like a fascinating experience that we're going to have at the Marsh.
Yeah. David, thank you so much.
Of course. A little bit of the music of Theodore Hulsker created especially for Hope More Dance. This weekend, Hope More Dance presents its 8th spring season, featuring 2 world premieres, including a collaboration with Christian Burns. The performances are at the ODC Theater, and both Hope More and Christian join me in studio to talk about the shows. Hope More is a choreographer, curator, and writer, and she's danced for many dance pioneers, including Lucinda Childs, Tricia Brown, and Margaret Jenkins. In 2007, she founded Hope More Dance. She's currently an artist in residence at ODC Theater and has a 2015 residency at Stanford Arts Institute. She blogs regularly on dance and has published the work Women and Performance, a Journal of Feminist Studies. Welcome back to our studios, Hope.
Thanks so much.
Sure, of course. And Christian Burns, is a collaborator for these spring productions of Hope More Dance. He's been performing, teaching, and directing, as well as speculating about the various ways we can experience, observe, and shape motion through the body since 1993. His work, both in dance and dance video, has been presented throughout the San Francisco Bay Area and the country, and internationally at venues in Europe and Taiwan. And his choreographic commissions include works for Liz Fane Dance, Alonzo King Lines Ballet, the James Sewell Ballet, and many others. Christian, welcome to Open Air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure. Well, let's talk about the show. I know that improvisation figures prominently in the show. So what I do know, I know about acting improv. I know, but don't do well, improvising in jazz, which, you know, gives us an outline of a tune and some chord changes to work around and to veer from. Baroque improvisation usually has a bass line and some numbers of figured bass to vary. But what exactly is dance improv, and is there an outline for that? Christian, want to take that?
Well, dance improvisation is really based on finding a way of working, finding a series of agreements that you are going to share with the collective ensemble so that you're not, attaching to completely disparate ideas, but you're going to find a way of working together and a way of making decisions together. And the physical vocabulary that we work with is really sourcing the libraries of each of the individual dancers. Everyone's got their own background, their own training, their own sort of histories of how they've been dancers. And we let there'd be room for those techniques and backgrounds to be present in their physicality. And what we really practice is making decisions together and training and rehearsing how to assert judgment in the moment where decisions need to be made.
So some of the improvisation is I don't want to say repeated, but the basics of certain moves or certain sequences are brought back, and then there's variation on that every time it's done.
Well, we really do study classical composition as well, I think, in terms of looking at simple ideas of symmetry and asymmetry. And so we do work with playing with balance and proportion and repetition.
The piece on the program this weekend is scored. It's not completely free form. Mm. So it's a 30-minute experience, and there are sections in which we've scored out things like energy and the kinds of forms in the space, such as solos and duets, and even have names, qualitative names for certain sections like cowboy, which can refer to certain kinds of physicality. So there are compositional layers to the improvisation and certain rules that the dancers play with. So what we've been interested in is really a balance of rules and freedom and colliding compositional intention with improvisational awareness. Mm-hmm.
So that must take a lot of rehearsal time then.
It does. I like to think of it more as practice because it feels more like a practice. The word practice seems to fit really well. It's not like a fixed set of moves that you keep repeating over and over again. It's more like tuning, a daily tuning of an instrument. And especially with an ensemble, it's really important that you tune together.
Hmm. Neat. And how did you guys first meet each other?
We've known each other through the community, and as individual artists, we were interested in getting in the studio together, and so this work grew out of a duet, an improvisational duet practice that we've cultivated now over 3 years. And the practice began not with any performative intention, but simply out of a shared commitment to a rigorous studio practice. And then we became interested in this core question of how does practice become performance? And gradually over time, we then became interested in how can we transmit these values to an ensemble? Mm-hmm. So for this project, we've stepped out of the roles as performers and now are co-directors.
Nice, nice. And so how many dancers are involved in this particular collaboration with Christian?
We have six dancers, a really phenomenal collection of dancers, varied backgrounds of experience, and extremely intelligent, thoughtful, and very physically nuanced, really beautiful movers.
Something that's really interesting about the ensemble is that some of them I think would identify more as ballet-trained dancers, and some of them would identify more as modern dancers. And so I think it's unusual in this community, this ensemble, it's really a mix of people who come more from the ballet lineage and others who come more from modern training, and they are dancing together and sharing practices and tools, which has been really a really rich conversation.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And we're going to talk about the other work on the program shortly, but for this work with Christian, what are we going to see on stage in addition to the dancers?
Well, it's going to be the piece runs about 34 minutes long. It's a very simple, pretty sparse set design by David Sosla, who's our other third collaborator, whom Hope and I have been working with for the previous 2 years when it was just our duet practice. And so there's very simple light instruments that have a presence in the piece that they interact with. But besides that, it's a pretty open space. And I just wanted to kind of get in really quickly that just to make sure that you know, you get a sense of it. There's a lot of play involved. There's a lot of real fantastic, energetic, unpredictable, at times quite hysterical, at times very moving, moments of real surprise that are executed with a real experienced, you know, hand of precision. So it's a real fun balance of hopefully for the audience to really experience a real journey of experiences that are changing constantly.
So even though there's going to be a heavy improvisational element mm-hmm. on each night of the performances, mm-hmm. the piece as a whole will still have an overarching arc,
yes.
so to speak.
Yeah, there's definitely a structure. There's an overarching arc, and there's a number of sections, as Hope had mentioned, which have their own arcs within them. And we're pretty mindful of, I mean, Hope and I both have, you know, a very kind of paralleling background in working non-improvisationally, you know, working with other choreographers. And I think we've got a real shared aesthetic of wanting to produce a dance that, you know, perhaps if it wasn't even mentioned, maybe someone wouldn't necessarily even know it was improvised. I think it's, you know, we're kind of trying to play with this space of, you know, making the best dance we can. Improvisation is definitely the subject that we're working with, but it's not necessarily the only kind of goal. It's sort of trying to really make the best dance that incorporates spontaneity as well as pre-planned, you know, ideas.
Mm-hmm. So is this leading to some further collaborations down the road?
We've really enjoyed working together, and I think we have an ongoing commitment to practice. So nothing formal in the works, but it'll be an ongoing relationship, I'm sure.
Yeah.
We started off the segment with a bit of the music of Theodor Hulsker, created originally for your work, Stay. So Stay, as I understand it, is a dance involving your reaction to the paintings of Francis Bacon.
Yeah, for this work, Stay, I was inspired to create a movement universe that conjures the same kind of visceral and emotional feelings that I get when I sit with a Francis Bacon painting. So when I sit with his work, it stirs up a whole lot of feelings inside of me. I think the works are very ambiguous. They can be disturbing. At the same time, they're non-narrative. And so I was really drawn to this combination in his work of not a narrative universe, but nonetheless a very emotionally compelling universe. So I was interested in creating a choreographic response to those paintings. The work doesn't duplicate the imagery per se, but I hope that it echoes the feelings of the paintings.
Mm-hmm. So will we actually see some of the Bacon projections?
No, although if you're familiar with his work, there are some of the motifs. For example, he likes to use the arrows in X-rays, and there are a couple of sculptural elements in the work that are handheld large arrows that the dancers move around the space to direct the gaze and play with the audience's awareness of the gaze. And so that comes directly from Bacon's work, as well as his use of really saturated color.
Mm-hmm. And I've talked with Theodore Halsker in a past show here about the work he's done with Mugwumpin. So he's doing some interesting collaborations.
Yeah, Teddy's made a fantastic soundscape for the work, very richly layered. And I worked with him to collect the raw material for the palette, some of which is very edgy electronica, and other textures are more classical. And I think that echoes the mix in Bacon's work of very formal composition and also grotesque content.
It's pretty visceral.
Yes.
You react. I'm interested to see what you bring to the stage. How many people are dancing in that work?
There are five dancers in the piece. Yeah, three men and two women.
Nice. These are at ODC Dance, the work she's just speaking of. Hope Moore is talking about Stay with music by Teddy Halsker. The second half incorporates the work and the collaboration with Christian Burns. And the performances are this weekend at ODC Theater. Information at odcdance.org. Or you can also find more information at hopemoore.org. Hope, M-O-H-R.org. Hope, Christian, thanks so much for coming in today. Wish you some fabulous performances.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Dance on. Listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio. Still to come, Diane Keough will be by with some summer fun down in the Peninsula Ways, especially. Also be talking with Ming Luke about his collaboration with the Berkeley Community Chorus and Orchestra and the Verdi Requiem. And the music in the background, well, that's the music of Grammy Award-winning jazz violinist Mads Tolling. He'll be joining the 24-voice San Francisco choral artists for their first SFCA Plus One concerts. Both Mads and the SFCA Artistic Director Megan Solomon join me in studio today. They'll be performing June 6th at St. Mark's Episcopal Church, and then the following weekend, the 13th and 14th, in San Francisco and Oakland. Mads, Megan, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you for having us. Yeah,
thanks so much.
Well, welcome back to Megan. I'm so pleased to have her back and very pleased to have Mads. We've talked about having you on and then suddenly said, oh, he's coming with Megan. Fantastic.
Yeah, good timing.
Yeah, indeed. Well, that's a bit of a jazzy start for the segment here. Is that how you're incorporating your music into the choral aspect? Or let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, it's one of them. What we really kind of are doing here with this collaboration is trying to have the improvisatory aspects of jazz and also have, you know, sort of an instrument that lends itself well for a choir. I think when I think of the violin, I think of it as being one of the closest instruments to the human voice. So it blends pretty nicely that way. And then what I can kind of add on top of the instrument blending fairly well is, you know, knowing about jazz, knowing how to groove. So that's what I will incorporate in this, creating some rhythms, creating some moments of spontaneity on top of what is planned out, you know, because the choir isn't improvising in the same way. So it's really a sort of a crossover thing we're onto here.
I guess so. Megan, the San Francisco choral artist has premiered over 230 works, won the 2012 ASCAP Chorus America Award for Adventurous Programming.
So and this, actually, if I can boast a little, also we
please.
Just won it again for 2015.
Oh, very nice. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And so this is an interesting collaboration. What made you, did you come up with this idea, first of all, of the SFCA plus one?
Yes, I did. This is our 30th anniversary, and we're very proud to have managed to have 30 years in the black doing contemporary
Mazel tov,
choral music.
My goodness.
Yes, thank you.
And, or whatever the Danish equivalent of Mazel tov is.
Skål.
Skål, of course.
Like the skull. The Vikings came out with that one, I think.
We have had this sort of pattern of every big anniversary of adding another composer program to our list. We started with the composer in residence, and then we added the New Voices project, and then we added the composer not in residence. And for our 30th anniversary, I thought it'd be nice to do something where we could add some additional instrumental color without getting involved in orchestras and things like that. So I conceived of this. There's not very much repertoire for chorus in one instrument, and I thought it'd be an interesting way to proceed.
Mm-hmm. And Mads, have you discovered any works with chorus before this? Violin and chorus?
Not violin and chorus specifically, I must admit. I was familiar with the Jan Garbarek recording, some of the things he had been doing with choir. And it seems to be a thing in Scandinavia. My countryman who passed away a few years back, Nils Henning Ørsted Petersen, did some recordings with a Danish choir as well. So in Scandinavia, they have this thing with choir. They like that sort of sing from the mountains kind of thing in the Norwegian fells, I guess. But yeah, but nonetheless, this is a very new thing and a very kind of a learning experience for me, for sure, is trying to fit in, trying to blend and fit in with this new instrument that I'm not used to.
How much were you able to let your hair down, so to speak? I remember those days myself. I mean, 9 years with the Turtle Island String Quartet. You guys did some pretty adventurous programming there, but it was more of a traditional nature.
Yeah, well, the Turtle Island Quartet really is really a jazz string quartet, and the first of its kind when it started in 1986. And what we did with that group was take things like, we would take Chick Corea, we would do John Coltrane, even Jimi Hendrix, but make that happen in a string quartet with all the rhythms that you can create in these instruments, like the chop, shuffle bow that we borrowed from bluegrass music, incorporate that with jazz and improvisation, having the cellos play bass lines. And that was a lot of my training, you know, for 9 years in that group, and then playing with the great Stanley Clark as well, the bass player that was in his band for also about that amount of time. So all those things kind of is my background now, doing my own things, my own groups.
Nice.
And this latest thing here.
Well, it was with Turtle Island that you were part of the group that won 2 Grammys for Best Classical Crossover Album with 4+4 and A Love Supreme, The Legacy of John Coltrane.
That's right.
Congratulations
yeah.
on that.
Yeah, thank you.
So what projects are you working on solo-wise then, other than these types of collaborations?
Right. The latest project I'm doing is with my own band, which is a quartet of violin, guitar, or now it's actually piano, bass, and drums. And our project is called Mads Men, which is kind of cleverly, you know, playing words with the series now just over Mad Men. And we're actually playing hits and themes and movie and TV series themes from the 60s, from that Mad Men era, and kind of combining it, you know, some of those things that I just love, The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, and Meet the Flintstones, and that kind of stuff.
What fun.
So that's kind of our latest project, and we're going to go in the studio with that in probably July and make an album with that. So that's sort of my latest thing is doing my own band and making that happen.
Well, can we hear something live in studio here, and then we'll talk more about the collaboration with the choral artists?
Absolutely,
yeah. What would you like to play for us?
I have a piece here. This is people debate if it was written by Bill Evans or Miles Davis, but I think the verdict is Bill Evans. And this is his beautiful ballad called Blue and Green from the album Kind of Blue that was recorded. And I actually recorded this as well on an album called Speed of Light. So, but this is my version of Blue and Green.
Mads Toling live in the KLW studios. Hit it. Good mad playing from Matt Stolling live in the KLW studios. That's brilliant, man.
Thank you, David.
Really beautiful play.
Thanks a lot.
Mads will be collaborating with the San Francisco Choral Artists the weekend of June 6th and the following weekend. Megan Solomon here, the executive director, artistic director of San Francisco Choral Artists, to talk about that collaboration as well. Megan, you're in for a treat. This must have been
Absolutely.
A nice process.
It's been wonderful and something we've wanted to do for the Choral Artists have wanted to do for a long time. Mm.
So the program is called, what, let me get this correctly, Old Masters, Young Prodigies, including music by composers who really didn't live long enough to become old masters.
Exactly. That was our idea, yeah. Turning 30 made us think a lot about age and youth, and there are so many wonderful composers who didn't have a chance to grow old, and we wanted to especially celebrate them, bring some of them to the attention. You know, they're lots of very famous people, the Felix Mendelssohn and his sister Fanny, Gideon Klein, who tragically died in a concentration camp at the age of 26, Schubert, of course, Moses Hogan, who was probably the best arranger of spirituals of the second half of the 20th century, Hugo Wolf, Johann Hermann Schein, Juan Inés de la Cruz, and George Gershwin. We try to cover the lot, and so those, I think, they all would have become old masters. And, of course, since we had a young prodigy with us, we thought that would be a nice combination.
Nice combination, indeed. One of the composers that is represented is a familiar name to me, Bielawa.
Mm-hmm.
Herb Bielawa. Talk to me about the music that he's involved for this concert, and it also involves Mads.
Right. He's written two series of rants on the poems of Jeannie Poole. They're spectacular pieces for choir and solo violin, and we've recorded a bunch of them, and it was the perfect opportunity to bring one of them back. This one is called You Drive Me Crazy, and that is indeed what the text is all about. I can share some of it with you if you wish, or I think actually you played a little of it before.
We will.
Okay, great. Herb lives in Kensington and has been a major, major influence on the composing scene here in the Bay Area for many, many years. He taught also for many years. His daughter, Lisa, is now also involved with the San Francisco Girls Chorus. So we have two generations working here in the area with contemporary music.
Lisa, we know well. She's been on a couple of times talking about her fantastic projects, the Chrissy Field Project and
right.
other things.
Mm-hmm.
She's really done some amazing things. So this is her dad.
This is her dad.
Nice. Let's hear a little bit of that music to go out with. We'll hear one of from the five rants of Herbert Bielawa, You Drive Me Crazy. We won't hear Mads performing here. We'll hear Brooke Aird on violin. But you are indeed conducting the San Francisco Choral Artists. Mads, I'm looking forward to you spending some time here on the air again sometime soon.
Oh, absolutely. It was my pleasure. Really nice to see you again, David.
Now that you're back in, you're kind of based in the area now.
Yeah, right? Albany. I've been here for a while and love it here.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you both for coming in today. More information about the concerts at the San Francisco Choral Artists website, sfca.org. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And music of Herb Bielawa from his rants, You Drive Me Crazy. Bielawa, you drive me crazy. One of his five rants for SATB Choir and Solo Violin. It's going to be one of the featured works for the San Francisco Choral Artists performances, sfca.org for more information. Also coming up this weekend is some performances by the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra and special soloists. That's next weekend, actually. Music from the Verdi Requiem, which we'll hear shortly. It's going to be conducted by Ming Luke, the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra's music director. Ming has been the music director for the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra, only the third such director in its 48-year history. In the past season alone, he has also worked with ensembles across the United States, the United Kingdom, Russia, the Czech Republic, all around Europe. He's conducted at the Kennedy Center for the Opera Orchestra, the San Francisco Ballet Orchestra, as well as Opera San Jose, Sacramento Opera, and the Napa Valley Symphony, among many others. And through the magic of radio, he joins me by telephone to talk about these upcoming concerts. Hi, Ming.
Hi, David. How's it going?
Good, thanks. Sorry you couldn't join us here in studio, but we do have a few minutes to hopefully share a little bit about the Mozart Requiem. Now, this is one of the masterpieces of Western musical literature. It has somewhat of an interesting history. Some of the music was originally intended for a collaborative work of several composers as a requiem for Rossini.
Yes, it's a fantastic work, and, you know, Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra is very much looking forward to performing it. But, you know, its history sort of lends itself to what BCCO is all about, too, because BCCO is a collaborative organization, you know, with the philosophy that music should be available to all, which is something I think we all share, but their execution of it is something a little different than some other organizations. For instance, you know, while all concerts are free, there are absolutely no auditions for the chorus, and so you could have been singing with the San Francisco Symphony Chorus for 20 years, and you're certainly welcome to join. Or you could have never had a music lesson in your life, don't even know how to read music, and you can join. But it's through the power of this community that they can perform great works like the Verdi. And, of course, you know, Verdi's original, when Rossini passed away, he wanted to gather some of the best composers to create this grand work, this requiem that would honor this great composer. But it fell through from squabbling about payment and who would be first and some logistical issues. And it was only until the poet Manzoni passed away that Verdi decided to take out the requiem by himself and created this great masterwork.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mentioned Mozart earlier, but of course the Verdi Requiem. And I know it originally as the Manzoni Requiem, thanks to, and I'm going to give a little shout out here, to my high school band director from freshman year. Her name then was Ruth Ann King. She's Ruth Ann Heller now. But she had this band arrangement of the Manzoni Requiem. It's the first Verdi I ever heard in my life, freshman in high school, and it just hooked me. It's such amazing music. So yeah, a shout out to band versions of this as well.
One of the things that the chorus has been very much enjoying is that, you know, there are obviously a lot of requiems for the symphonic choral literature, but the thing that's very special about the Verdi is how exaggerated and operatic the music really is. And so while you might have, you know, very structure-based Mozart Requiem or the beautiful Durflay Requiem, which takes out a lot of the Day of Destruction depictions to make a little bit more flowing requiem, or of course the Brahms Requiem, which was written, of course, for the living, to comfort the living, and concludes obviously none of the very little of the Requiem text. But I mean, the Verdi Requiem, you know, extends the sequence in the Dies Irae, the Day of Destruction, and of course, being a phenomenal operatic composer, really takes this heavy romantic feel to the Requiem text and has these incredible musical depictions of the Requiem.
So tell us about some of the difficulties that, this I mentioned, such a major work for a chorus that is basically a community chorus.
Yeah, and so, you know, I mean, oftentimes, especially nowadays, we have a division between so-called professional and community, but, you know, Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra, the community part is really part of its pride, because it's really through the experience and the desire of all the people in the ensemble that allows us to tackle on these really phenomenal works. Like in the past, we've done Dvorak Requiem, we've done St. John Passion, a lot of very, very difficult works. But, you know, because there are so many people in the chorus, there's about 230 people in weekly rehearsals and approximately 170 to 185 people on stage performing, the fact that, you know, through the collective experience of all of them, they really can tackle all these works. The biggest difficulty, I think, with the Verdi, you know, especially since we're talking about the deep and over, you know, these emotions that are just overflowing, is to really try to emphasize those. You know, in the Lacrimosa, instead of just having single notes that are sung by the altos and sopranos accompanying the major melody, you know, how can you make those as crying as possible, as lamenting? And of course, the Dies Irae, with its, you know, bass drum, is phenomenal and exciting. But there are so many other parts of the Requiem that have incredibly shimmering feels to it, dramatic, or loving and tender that you really want to bring out. And so it's bringing out those the various textures of the Requiem that I think has been the challenge for us.
Well, these performances will be the 5th, 6th, and 7th in Hertz Hall in the campus of UC Berkeley. And I imagine you're well into planning the 50th anniversary season next year.
Yes, so BCCO is 50 years old next year, and we have a fantastic season. The fall concert program is sort of a retrospective and a little bit of a look forward. And so we're going to be featuring some of the works that BCCO has performed and is very symbolic for the organization, including, well, things like, of course, like the Brahms Requiem, parts of Messiah, which part of the history of the organization. But we're also really excited because we had a composer competition to commission a work for the 50th anniversary, and Bay Area composer Kurt Erickson is going to be composing a work, and we're very excited about that collaboration. But in the spring, BCCO will be doing the War Requiem, which is one of the great works that's not often performed as much as some of the other ones.
Benjamin Britten, yes.
Yeah, because of the logistical issues of how large the chorus is, large the orchestra is, and the difficulty of the work. And so we're really excited about that.
Well, let's have you back in the flesh to talk about those next time.
Sounds great.
Ming, have some wonderful performances. This weekend you'll also hear a soloists, Carrie Hennessy on soprano, Alex Boyer tenor, Lisa Vanderplug mezzo-soprano, and James Demler baritone. We'll talk to you again soon, Ming.
Thanks, David. Bye.
Information about the concerts at bcco.org. And a few minutes with Diane Keough in just a moment about some upcoming summer activities. Some of the more calm moments from a very tempestuous Verdi Requiem, the Ricordare, music by Giuseppe Verdi, which the Berkeley Symphony, Berkeley Community Chorus and Orchestra will be performing, bcco.org. A few minutes now with Diane Keough to talk about things down on the peninsula. Hello again, Diane.
Hi, Dave. Do you want me to start with the kids' things or with coming attractions?
Let's start with some kids' stuff.
Okay. Okay, anyone who has a child of age up to about 18 that's interested in doing anything in the performing arts, grab a pencil or a pen and a piece of paper. Or if you're really good with the computer, get your computer out, because I'm going to give a lot of information out.
We'll put it on our website as well.
Good. Okay, well, the Hill Barn, let's start with the Hill Barn in Foster City. It has a website where you can see all of the opportunities they have and an FAQ, which does a great job of answering the questions for information. It's the Hill Barn Conservatory Summer Stage, ages 4 to 18. Starting on June 15th, the telephone number is 650-349-6411. And it's got the... other one is, I don't know, why do they still use HTTP? Do you have to use that?
I don't
that
think any of that anymore.
I don't either, but a lot of places still have it. But anyway, if you do that with the, that and then the two slant forwards and the www and all that goodness, it's hillbarntheater.
Easy to do now to search for Hill Barn Theater and something will pop up.
.org/education.
There you go.
And they have a wonderful program already for the kids. It's called Dare to Live, and they're going to be producing with these kids this summer Alice in Wonderland, Cinderella, West Side Story, and Rent, which... too kind of difficult.
That's very tough stuff, yeah.
Okay, TheaterWorks has a really broad array of programs for kindergarten through 12th grade. The way to get involved with that, because it's so all-encompassing, I can't even talk about it, so there's so many things, it's to get a hold of the Associate Education Director there. His number is 650-463-7153. His name is Jake Arkey, and that is at theaterworks.org/youth.
Lots of theater things for the kids this summer, I guess.
Well, there's many more. And the City of Palo Alto Children's Theater has a wide variety. City of Palo Alto Children's Theater is how you get to them. San Carlos Children's Theater, 650-594-2730. And here's a new thing that's happening. Broadway by the Bay is partnering with the Peninsula Ballet Theater with workshops for students aged 4 through 16. The classes are in dance for musical theater, including basics of ballet, jazz, tap, and lyrical, along with vocal training and acting skills. Now, that's a pretty encompassing program. Hmm. And that's at thepeninsulaballet.org, and you can go on for there. The Pinson Peninsula Symphony has, and you're familiar with this one, Dave.
I am indeed.
Has bridges to music, in-school programs, youth competitions, Marilyn Mandel piano competition, young musicians competitions aged 9 to 18, and high school master classes, and that's at peninsulasymphony.org.
Well, that makes a nice segue to the Peninsula's free concert coming up on June 13th. That's going to be in Hillview Park in Los Altos at 6:30. Information at peninsulasymphony.org. But there's lots more free music happening down on the peninsula, isn't there, Diane?
Yeah, there's a lot of music happening down there. First, I want to do one that is not free, and that's the Masterworks Chorale. It's very different. It's presenting a semi-staged Les Mis on Saturday at 8 o'clock and on Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Congregational Church at the corner of Tilton and California Drive in San Diego. Ticket Masterworks of San Diego and San Mateo. I don't want to doing down in San Diego today. 1-800-838-3006 or at the door. That is Saturday or Sunday for Masterworks Chorale presenting singing Les Mis in a very lightly staged version.
That's this weekend?
This weekend, yeah.
Okay,
here we go with the free stuff. Redwood City Music on the Square, Fridays from 6 to 8 p.m. 19 concerts starting this weekend. Redwood City Jazz on Main, 8 p.m., July 28th. Jazz on the Hill, June 6th, College of San Mateo. And it's free, and just drive up and go in. June 13th, as Dave was just saying, the Peninsula Free Concert in Los Altos. Music in the Park, Belmont, from 2 to 4, June 14th, the first of 7 Sundays. June 20th, Redwood Symphony at Redwood Square at 6:30. And June 25th, Foster City Central Park Music from 6 to 8. Now, that's a lot of stuff to do.
It is a lot. Boy.
And I just have a really quick mention of two things I saw. One of them was curtains at Hillbarn Theater, and it's on this weekend. And if you get a chance to go see it, you're going to laugh and laugh and laugh. And it's just I can't get into it because we don't have enough time. And the other thing that I saw, and it's going to be at it's going to be down someplace. I can't remember where I wrote it out there for you. But anyhow, it is the ballet from Smuin, which was called Unlaced. And it was the most wonderful evening in ballet I've had in years.
That's at the Lesher Center.
That's the one.
There we go. Yeah. And that's this weekend. It'll also be at the Carmel Sunset Center on June 5th and 6th.
Right, that's it. And go to see it if you have the opportunity. It is a delightful evening. There's a very interesting dance at the very end. It's a brand new one, and it is so exciting and different than anything you've ever seen. It's wonderful.
Well, in case you didn't have a pen and pencil handy, we will post some of this information at our website, kalw.org. Thanks for the speed version of things to do on the peninsula, and looks like you've been busy. You're quite busy yourself.
Yeah, I have. Well, getting all this is a big, big thing. But anyway, thank you, and I hope everybody enjoys their summer and goes to the theater a lot and has their kids take those classes.
I was going to say, no excuse for not having a thespian in your family now.
Absolutely.
Thanks to all of the programs on the peninsula. You'll find some more information at our website, kalw.org, at the Open Air tab. Thanks for listening. I'm David Latuli. Thanks also to Neil Swinkles for herding cats today for yet another parade of cultural adventures here on Open Air, here in the Bay Area. A reminder that all of our shows are archived at our website, kalw.org. If you've got a suggestion for a segment from some community performing arts group, by all means, send me an email, david@kalw.org. Thanks for listening. See you next week.